Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. This week, new and puzzling findings on brain cancer, where people can have chromosomes which actually look unusually healthy. And Australian research, which may bring what's called precision medicine a couple of steps closer in another difficult-to-treat cancer. And a paper in this morning's Medical Journal of Australia points to a way to a much more effective way of making the healthcare system sustainable than a GP co-payment. It's by reducing the use of low-value tests and treatments, which in many people do no good and sometimes do harm. We've spoken before in the Health Report about the Choosing Wisely campaign in the United States, and now it's washing up on our shores. Associate Professor Adam Elshaug is at the Menzies Centre for Health Policy at the University of Sydney. He's an international authority in this area and is involved in the Australian version of Choosing Wisely.
It is coming to our shores. The NPS Medicine Wise group have decided that the influence they have, very positive influence they have within the medical community, makes them a good leader to be a facilitator of this program within Australia.
What's it achieved in the United States? Well, first of all, you better tell us what it's about.
So Choosing Wisely commenced in the United States. In fact, it's the first truly physician-led program anywhere in the world where groups have got together, medical groups, doctors, to try and identify healthcare services, practices and tests, interventions that they think have little or no benefit for their patients.
In their area?
In their specific areas.
And have they managed to park conflict of interest at the door?
Some have. So interestingly, back in 2009 when the program started, there were 5 medical specialty societies on board. That has now grown to 60 medical specialty societies in the United States, which I think gives an indication that this was really something that snowballed and gained a huge degree of ground level support from the medical community.
Now, you've spent a lot of time here and in the United States researching what you call low value interventions, which are just the sort of things that these physician and surgeon societies are putting out there. Give us a flavour of the sort of things they put out there, because they give you lists of 5 and things to ask your doctor.
Exactly.
So it's aimed at consumers as well as doctors.
That's right. And the idea is that there's a conversation between doctors and patients about whether or not a particular intervention is going to deliver benefit. So there's all of the usuals. We know that imaging for low back pain, antibiotic use, a lot of blood tests, preoperative blood tests and things like that. But then there's some very distinct and particular interventions related to certain specialties, so within the cancer area. So what's interesting, Norman, is that I think some of the resistance to these sorts of campaigns in the past have been this notion that we're either saying something is high value or low value. That is, it should be done or it shouldn't be done.
So either yes or no, whereas it's really sometimes is the answer.
Sometimes is the answer. So it's actually about really trying to target those patient groups for whom the most benefit can be achieved. And in fact, then the test should be avoided on patients whom it could actually cause some harm.
And there's been criticism, before we come to what's going to be happening in the Australian context, there's been criticism of the United States saying, well, you know, they haven't told us how they came to these decisions, they haven't talked to enough doctors at the front line, and it's all bull.
Yes, there has been some criticism, which is actually a positive for the Australian program, because I think now the Australian program is on warning for some of the criticisms that they could expect if the methods aren't followed. So certainly some of the medical specialty societies in the United States did not utilise very democratic processes with their medical members, and I think those processes have been criticised, but others have actually...
Well, does democracy work when you've got evidence? I mean, if 100 physicians think that something works and one doesn't, but the one that doesn't has evidence on his or her side, then stuff democracy.
They do say that they want them evidence-based, and the American College of Emergency Medicine is the method that has stood out as being the gold standard.
So what have they done?
Well, initially what they did was they actually went to their entire base, where they actually started to get ideas generated. And then they took those away, discovered what the evidence base was around those proposals, and then went
so
back to their
members. So they sifted opinion from fact.
Exactly.
And I think that you've identified in your research 150 of these low-value interventions, which are, again, as you say, not either on or off. It's
right.
Here's the right situation where you should have it.
Exactly. So we know that within the Australian Medicare benefit schedule, there are a number of items, remembering that the benefit schedule here in Australia dates back to the 1980s at best. So a lot of items that found their way onto the schedule in the early days didn't really have the evidence base that we would ultimately like.
And just to translate that, these items are items against which you can claim back from Medicare the cost of the service, or if they're bulk billing, the doctor can claim directly.
That's right. And there's over 5,700 of those items on the Australian MBS.
So a bit of hoovering, a bit of vacuuming is required.
Yeah, a little bit of a spring clean. That's right.
So how's it going to work in Australia?
NPS are launching the program this year. They already have 5 or 6 of the specialty societies on board, including the larger groups, including the pathologists and the College of Physicians and the like. So they're now starting to go through the methods that they'll use, and I think they're learning from the experiences elsewhere. I should also mention that the campaign is running in Canada very successfully, the Netherlands, Germany, Italy.
Is it saving money?
Well, it is saving money. Certainly, the Canadian group particularly have been good about evaluating the impact of the program. In Australia, there have been some parallel programs, and I can report that just overnight I received some news that vitamin B12 and folate tests are on the Australian Medicare benefit schedule. And only a few months ago, they received some attention where the two tests used to be together, that is B12 and folate. They've been split apart.
They're of highly questionable value.
They are of highly questionable value, and there's been some very good evidence put out there that shows the diagnostic accuracy of these tests are to be questioned. And really, folate deficiency particularly isn't such a big problem today as it used to be. So we're thinking, why are we doing all of these tests to the degree that we once were? And just 3 or 4 months in, we can see now that the numbers are looking like the Medicare program is saving $4 million per month, so almost $50 million per annum.
By having done what?
As I said, they split the tests apart. So now doctors don't clump B12 and folate together as one test. They're separate tests. They refined the item descriptors. Now, what that means is every item number within the MBS has a description of a patient characteristic for whom that test is appropriate. And it was realised that that descriptor was out of date. So it's been refined to better target the patient groups who we think these tests are actually valuable for. And the fee was reduced on each because, of course, when you split them apart, they become two tests, so the fee should reduce. So
that affects the pathologist rather than the GP, though, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But overall, it affects the Australian taxpayer.
$50 million for almost a cost-free change.
Exactly. And it's just one example.
So what's the money out there in the Australian healthcare system that's waiting to be saved? Or redirected into more useful care probably is a more likely thing.
Yeah, so we're trying to do that work just now. The best indication that we have, I did an analysis in the US Medicare system where we looked at 26, just 26 low-value healthcare practices and how prevalent they are in the US Medicare system. And we found that there's over $8 billion of waste just on those 26 services in the US. Now, if we were to translate that directly to the Australian Medicare system, that would equate to almost $600 million annually in savings. But of course, that's assuming that
the utilization is the same.
It's the same, and we don't know that.
Even if it's $300 million, it's $300 million
right.
That could be diverted more usefully.
Exactly.
Low-value interventions don't just exist in what clinicians do to their patients. It also exists on how we organise the system and what managers do. Are we going to turn the spotlight on low-value interventions on managers?
I'm very pleased you raised that because the paper that we've just published in the Medical Journal of Australia, I was involved with the South Australian Clinical Senate where we ran...
This is a group of clinicians, doctors, nurses and others who advise the South Australian government on health policy.
Exactly. And interestingly, within the SA Clinical Senate, what they do is actually have a junior senate and a senior senate, and the junior senate is made up of training and junior doctors. So we actually asked the question of both the junior and the senior senators to nominate anonymously their top five in the spirit of choosing wisely. And we've published those lists in the Medical Journal of Australia, and really to our great surprise was that particularly many of the junior clinical senate members started to report on work practices, processes and protocols that they thought were wasteful, like duplication of documentation and the like. And that's a really unique thing that I don't think anyone else anywhere in the world has looked at with the Choosing Wisely campaign. So we've suggested that anybody considering going down the Choosing Wisely path consider not only a top five list of clinical services, but perhaps a top five list of administrative
system
process services as well.
And it's good sport going after the bureaucrats.
Absolutely. Turn the tables.
Adam Elshock, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Adam Elshaug is at the Menzies Centre for Health Policy at the University of Sydney. And you're at the Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. Last week, a major Australian study on one of the most dangerous malignancies, pancreatic cancer, was published in one of the world's top science journals, Nature. The results came from what's called the Australian Pancreatic Cancer Genome Initiative, where they've now looked in depth at the whole genome of pancreas tumours in about 100 people. One of the authors was Andrew Bianchin, who splits his time between the University of Glasgow and the Garvan Institute in Sydney.
So what we're seeing is what we call structural variations, and these are different to mutations where there's a change in a single base that might change an amino acid as part of a protein.
So just to explain, DNA is a structure of, you know, an alphabetic structure, if you like, of pairs, and you get a mutation which might just be in one of these pairs. There's about 3 billion of them. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about now is where, when you look at it, there's a big change to the structure.
Yeah, so large chunks of DNA are either falling off and disappearing. Large chunks are being what we call amplified, which have been multiplied and duplicated. So if you can imagine there's a cancer-causing gene underlying this, suddenly you might have 50 or more copies of that gene, and so that's driving your particular cancer. We also see a broad range of what we call stability in the genome. There are some genomes that are very quiet. There's not a lot of chunks missing, whereas some are very unstable. And so you've got a lot of activity going on. Big chunks of DNA are floating off, popping onto other chromosomes, and really it's a mess.
Do these changes relate to what happens to the person in real life? They live longer, whatever.
We don't see anything definite yet. There's only about 100 patients that we looked at in this first instance. But what we're starting to see is some relationship between the sort of cancer that develops or a particularly inherited predisposition to cancer, like a BRCA1 or a BRCA2 inherited mutation.
So that's what's traditionally known as the two breast cancer genes, and you're finding them in pancreatic cancer as well.
Yeah, so this is the Angelina Jolie gene. It predisposes to breast cancer and ovarian cancer predominantly, but we're also seeing some of these genes in pancreatic cancer. And we're seeing these genes that have been affected damage the repair mechanisms of DNA. Whilst that can cause the cancer to develop, we're also thinking that by using specific therapies that target these particular defects, that we can start to treat these particular cancers in a more precise or a more personalised way.
And is there any king hit here, in other words, or is it just of 100 people, it's all 1 or 2% incidence of all these different abnormalities that you're finding, or there is a common thread?
So that's why I think we're failing to develop many novel therapeutics and many novel treatments for cancer, is because we're developing drugs towards particular underlying mechanisms, particular defects in that particular cancer. If you group all cancers just by the way they appear on the microscope, you might only have 1 or 2 or 3%. That might not be important in a public health sense, but it's very important for an individual sense. So when you think about treating cancer, you don't think about one drug for 100 patients. You think maybe 20 drugs for 100 patients, but you want to match the right drug to the right patient.
So when you look at the various abnormalities that you've seen, given that it's pretty much a desert out there in terms of chemotherapy that works on people with pancreatic cancer, to what extent are you finding that there are some surprising treatments available which are very different from what you currently give to people with pancreatic cancer?
Yes, so we're seeing therapeutic targets that are used in other cancer types. That is, you might have a drug like Herceptin that targets amplified HER2 genes in breast cancer. We're seeing those amplifications in pancreatic cancer. We're seeing particular mutations that are used for treatment in other cancer types. But in those other cancer types, they might be present in 20, 30, 40, 50%. In the case of pancreatic cancer, we don't have what we call a dominant subtype.
So you can't just spray the drug to everybody. You've got to find out who's going to benefit from it.
So we need to change the way we approach pancreatic cancer. We need to understand what the subtypes are, look for opportunities to rescue and repurpose existing therapeutics where we already have drugs that are already developed, already on the market, used for other cancer types or even other diseases. When we see this particular subtype that is very similar to another cancer type, there's an opportunity to test that.
So have you got any examples in pancreatic cancer where that's starting to work?
So what we're seeing is really just some small signals, because we haven't designed the appropriate studies in order to address that. And where we're at this point in time is that we do what we call a discovery. So in this genomics initiative, the APGI, as part of the International Cancer Genome Consortium.
This is the Australian group.
That is the Australian group. So we had the opportunity to follow our patients as almost like a clinical trial. We couldn't change their treatment, but what we could do is follow what sort of treatment they received. And we're starting to see some relationships between the sort of treatment they received just by chance and the sort of underlying genomes. And what we're seeing in some of those circumstances, what we call exceptional responders. For some reason, a particular patient responds dramatically to a therapeutic. This tumor may look very similar to the next person's tumor, but one person responded dramatically and one didn't. If we dig into these cancer genomes and start to understand these differences, then perhaps we'll understand why a particular patient responded so dramatically and why another didn't. Based on this premise, the NCI has launched their Exceptional Responders Program.
National Cancer Institute in the United States.
That's right. We've also similarly launching a program here in Glasgow where, through our worldwide network and our connections, we're identifying those patients that had an exceptional or dramatic response to a treatment. Because there are so many variables in a genome, just seeing it in one or two individuals doesn't help. What we need to do is start to look at similarities and differences between those patients that responded versus those patients that didn't.
To see if you can find, if you like, a signature, a test that would identify them and say, you might be in that 1% group, but you could become an exceptional responder as well.
Yes, so the way we'd approach it is that we would develop what we call a biomarker hypothesis. That is, we have some biological marker, whether it be a genetic test or some other test, as to why we think this patient responded dramatically. We might take this into the laboratory and do a few extra experiments to understand it better, and then we change the way we perform a clinical trial. And what we do in that clinical trial, we pick the patients that we think are going to respond based on this biomarker, and we treat those patients. So we're enriching for those patients that are likely to benefit from the therapy.
So unlike a normal trial, which is random allocation over a wide group, you're actually going to pick your patients. And with pancreatic cancer, since it's such a dreadful cancer, if they do well, it's going to be obvious very soon.
That's exactly right. And the unfortunate thing with pancreatic cancer is that most people,
by the time you find out that it's wrong, it's too late.
That's exactly right. So most times you only have one chance at picking the right therapy, and it's either a roll of the dice or you want to stack your odds with doing some of these genetic assessments.
Now, the skeptics of genomics of tumours say, well, if you do enough biopsies of the tumour, you're going to get different genomes. In other words, so when they look at kidney cancer, I think they found that in different parts of the tumour, different genes were switched on and off. And therefore, to summarise this person's story is incredibly difficult, and also explains why the cancer has come back. What's the story of pancreatic cancer? How much difference is there within the tumour itself?
This is what we call intra-tumoral heterogeneity. So what we were talking about before was inter-tumoral heterogeneity, which is differences between people. What we're talking about now is differences within a particular tumour. Treatment will change your tumour. So if you have
the same way as treatment of an infection with an antibiotic changes the bug, and the resistant bugs within that population survive.
Yep. And there's evidence to show that even a drug holiday can improve survival. There's no doubt that resistance develops, and it probably develops through either the acquisition of new mutations or this selective pressure.
This precision pancreatic cancer network that you're setting up in the UK, so when somebody is diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, they have a biopsy, they have their genome done, and you do a clinical trial of a drug that's not normally used in pancreatic cancer, Herceptin or something else. Is that going to be in addition to the standard therapy that they would get, or instead of?
The approach is that we want to offer every patient a therapeutic option. This goes back to an argument as to whether we do have a standard of care for pancreatic cancer.
Because gemcitabine, which is the core drug for it, is very poorly studied and not very good.
Well, gemcitabine is not very good. We can add these drugs together and we get a bit of an effect, but the differences in survival we're looking at are basically in the measure of months. And so it's all about what is the right drug for that particular individual. Some of the trials will offer that if we see the right target. Other opportunities for novel therapies that we don't know a lot about, but we feel that it's quite reasonable for the patient to have and make an informed decision as to whether they want to take a novel agent or they want to go on to a standard of care. And if we do have a standard of care for pancreatic cancer, that standard is very low. So the opportunity to have access to a number of different therapeutics, some that match well, some that don't match so well.
And if they respond, then you study them in depth.
The new way we want to do clinical trials is not about big trials of thousands of patients where most of them fail. It's about smaller trials, a stepwise approach in that you fail early and you fail cheaply so that you can test a number of different approaches rather than just putting your money behind one horse and hoping that it works, because it hasn't worked in the past. We haven't really made any changes in 50 years. We're our own worst enemies. We can do the genomic testing now. We can start to test more. We understand more about these tests, but can we implement them in the clinic? The system isn't set up for it. The regulators aren't set up for it. Changing that is going to be our biggest challenge as a community.
But consumers are going to have to know more. In other words, if they think they've got pancreatic cancer, they're going to have to know and demand that their GP sends them in a certain direction, that it's not just to the casual surgeon who sees one person a year or two people a year with pancreatic cancer, that they go to an integrated pancreatic cancer centre.
In the end, in order for us to achieve this, the consumers or patients and the society in a broad sense will have to play a major role to direct us into a changing paradigm of how we approach not just cancer but other diseases. And this is what we call precision medicine, stratified medicine. So there's a piece about education and training that needs to happen, not only just for practitioners but also for patients.
Andrew Bianchin is Regius Professor of Surgery at the University of Glasgow. And one of the other institutions which drove this work was the Institute for Molecular Bioscience at the University of Queensland. Now to another dreadfully hard to treat tumour. It's called glioblastoma and is the commonest form of brain cancer. Kyle Walsh is in the Department of Neurological Surgery at the University of California, San Francisco. And he looks at the genes too, but in this case, in the person with the disease rather than in the tumour itself.
We work on glioblastoma trying to figure out what some of the causes of this disease are. And using a technique called genome-wide association studies, which essentially we will look at about a million markers, genetic markers that are inherited in a large group of patients who have a glioblastoma. And we'll look at those same markers in a large group of individuals who are healthy, tumor-free controls. And what we try to find are variants that are more common in the ill people than in the healthy control group. And those are markers then that are associated with and linked to genes influencing glioblastoma risk. The first one of these genome-wide association studies that came out for gliomas or glioblastomas specifically came out in 2009, and that was published by my postdoctoral mentor, Margaret Wrench, and her collaborators here at UCSF, John Winkie, and also at Mayo Clinic, Bob Jenkins. And that first paper found several genetic variants that were associated with glioblastoma risk, but two that were particularly interesting were in genes called TERT and RTEL1. Now, both of those genes are involved in the maintenance and in the stability of the telomere. So telomeres are these protective caps on the ends of chromosomes. As cells age and divide, the telomeres grow shorter and shorter. And so TERT actually encodes the reverse transcriptase portion of the telomerase enzyme, which lengthens telomeres. So variation in the gene TERT is thought to be associated with variation in telomerase activity, and therefore with how long or how short a person's telomeres are.
And in general, it's thought that the longer your telomere, the better off you are.
Absolutely. The longer your telomeres are, the better off you are. And this is largely sort of associated with the fact that younger people have longer telomeres. And so as you age, your telomeres get shorter. But telomeres have been proposed, especially telomere length, as a very interesting biomarker of what we think of as biological age, sort of distinct from chronological age. So a 50-year-old with longer telomeres might be smoking less, eating more healthy foods, exercising more than a 50-year-old with shorter telomeres. But these are also influenced by genetics, just like health in general. It's your diet, it's your behavior, it's also your genetics. So this was very interesting that this cancer, this malignant brain tumor, was associated with variants in telomere-related genes. So this past year, I was working on a project to increase the number of individuals in our study that had glioblastoma. And so this was, again, same thing, collaborative project, so UCSF and Mayo investigators. And we added additional samples, more and more people had better power, and we found a new gene associated with glioblastoma risk. And so this is the eighth gene now identified to be associated with glioblastoma risk. And this gene is the gene called TERC. So TERC, you may notice, sounds an awful lot like TERT. And so TERC and TERT together form the enzyme telomerase. And so this really, at this point, hit us right between the eyes. It's pretty clear now
that the telomere is key to glioblastoma.
Exactly, that something related to telomere length or telomerase activity is key to glioma predisposition.
So, and does telomerase shorten or lengthen telomeres, or does it both?
It primarily elongates telomeres. So its activity, when it's turned on, is to lengthen telomeres. Telomerase is usually turned off in most normal adult cells, but it's turned on in stem cells. It gets reactivated in cancer cells, and it's also active in germ cells. And so we thought this was very interesting, but there's been this long debate about our shorter telomeres. They're certainly associated with older age, probably associated with cancer risk. Are short telomeres going to predispose a person to glioblastoma, or are longer telomeres going to predispose a person to glioblastoma? And there are sort of multiple angles on this, as with anything good in science, yes. I was open to it really going either way. I wasn't sure what it would be, but we actually think that we've largely addressed this question. So we incorporated data from a study from the UK, and what they had done was they measured telomere length in blood in about 40,000 individuals, and they performed their own genome-wide association study. They found 8 genes that were associated with telomere length in blood.
And guess what?
3 of them overlapped with our glioma genes, so TERT, TERC, and RTEL1. So we used their data and the data that had been produced here and overlaid the two and showed that in the gene TERT, all of the variants that were associated with increased glioma risk were associated with longer telomere length. And we found the same thing at TERC, that all of the genetic variants associated with increased glioblastoma risk were associated with longer telomere length. So this really was...
This is kind of a perverse finding.
It was certainly a little paradoxical. You know, I mean, again, there are certainly people who would have assumed one thing or the other, but we think that it's sort of an unbiased way of looking at this. And so you end up observing that things that are associated with longer telomere length are also associated with greater glioma risk, and these are variants that these individuals have had since they were born.
So this could be just an accidental finding that somebody who gets glioblastoma happens to have long telomeres and it's nothing to do with anything. Is there any idea that this actually is causally related to whether or not you get this dreadful malignant brain tumor?
To sort of look at that, there's a very interesting paper that was published recently where they found that in glioblastoma tumors, there were acquired mutations. So these are genetic variants that people didn't inherit. They happened due to a mutation, whether that was caused by any exposure or whatever, to the point that these mutations are in the promoter of the gene TERT. And they're found in about 80% of glioblastoma patient tumors. So this gene that we've linked to glioma risk for inherited variants also has acquired mutations that are associated with glioma and are found in the tumors. And what that mutation does is it reactivates the TERT gene, increases the gene's expression. Functionally, this has been observed now, and it increases expression of telomerase. And its function in cells is to lengthen telomeres.
Really, why should a longer telomere increase your risk of brain cancer?
The progressive shortening of telomeres is a mechanism by which cells die. It's a mechanism of what we call apoptosis. Well, because this is a mechanism of cell death, and cancer is the unregulated growth and proliferation of cells.
So maybe simply stopping the brain cells dying.
Exactly, that having longer telomeres gives cells extra cellular divisions that they can go through, gives them a head start, enables them to live a little bit longer, and therefore could predispose you to brain tumors.
So are there drugs which block TERT or TERC or TERC?
Yeah, there are in early experiments, and I think maybe as far as phase 2 trials, they've been looking at telomerase inhibitors. So these are things that would inhibit the activity of telomerase and inhibit the telomere lengthening effects of telomerase when it's reactivated. The problem with these is that telomerase is important for lots of cells in your body. So if you are turning telomerase off and shortening your telomeres,
it's not a targeted therapy.
It's not a targeted therapy. It's going to inhibit the telomere lengthening in your tumor, but it's going to do it in many other cells in your body, and so that's problematic. So the important aspect might be to find a more targeted way of doing this by looking at perhaps the mutation in the TERT promoter that we've observed and seeing if that can be specifically targeted, or, you know, one of these other things. So maybe it's not to actually target TERT itself, but to target what turns on the TERT gene.
So all roads are seeming to lead to the telomere.
All roads do seem to be leading to the telomere right now. And that's very exciting because, you know, for a long time, the genetic etiology, the underpinnings of glioma were very elusive. And I think it still remains that way. But this is a really great sort of jump start and gets us pointed down a direction that seems to be making sense and is of interest, at least to us, and we think to patients as well.
Carl Walsh is in the Department of Neurological Surgery at the University of California, San Francisco. And the interesting thing here is, anecdotally, if you ask neurosurgeons about people with brain cancer, they tell you they're often quite fit people. Anyway, Carl Walsh is in the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of California, San Francisco. I'm Norman Swan, and this has been the Health Report. I'll see you next week.